In these weeks leading up to Christmas, the world around us is increasingly red and green. On my drive-in this morning, I noticed the new Christmas lights that are up in downtown Cary, and they are awesome. But here in the sanctuary, the liturgical color will stay blue, this really gorgeous deep blue, until Christmas Eve, which is the fourth and final Sunday of Advent this year. And on December 24th, after the morning services, the altar guild is going to put away the blue and drape the altar in bright white. The color of the Advent hangings here, these are called paraments. These remind us of the color of the early morning sky when the sun is well below the horizon line and before those first birds start making noise. And these altar hangings are the color of the quietest hour. Sometimes photographers will call it the blue hour. This blue is from the Sarum Rite, which is the original basis for liturgy in the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. And it's where blue was first started to be used during Advent. It was often specified that it was an indigo blue to represent this darkness, a darkness before birth, a darkness before dawn. And the use of blue on a practical level distinguishes the season of Advent from the 40 days of Lent, during which we use purple. This blue in the sanctuary invites us in to come in here from this blitz of red and green to take an inventory of why our world and our lives need the brightness of Christmas to come in the first place. During Advent, the church spends time with three different ways in which God comes to us. The first coming is Jesus of Nazareth, Mary's baby boy. The second way that God comes to us is God's presence in our own lives, here and now. Jesus comes to us as the stranger, the one who is hungry, and the one who is in prison. Matthew's gospel tells us that. The third concept of God coming to us is Jesus' return at the end of time. Today, the first Sunday of Advent, the readings point to this third coming of Jesus coming at the end of time. The prophet Isaiah sets the stage for us this morning, and the year was about 530 BC. The Israelites had just returned from exile in pagan Babylon, and their homecoming was disappointing. God had apparently deserted the Israelites, and they had made a mess out of things in their homeland as well. Isaiah, the prophet, wails to God about what the people have come to, saying to God, "Because you hid yourself, we transgressed. We have all become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a filthy cloth. There is no one who calls on your name or attempts to take hold of you, for you have hidden your face from us, and have delivered us into the hand of our iniquity." The prophet Isaiah is not known for his subtlety. We might imagine Isaiah among us now, his voice a little too shrill. He would be the one talking politics at our dinner table too loudly, or asking a way too personal question of us during coffee hour. Isaiah's directness about God's apparent absence, though, gives us the language to talk about the difficult realities of our lives and of our world. Listen again to the prophet's complaint to God about the mess that the Israelites have made in their homeland. And these are the verses immediately following the ones in which we heard read just now. He continues, "Your holy cities are all ghost towns. Zion is a ghost town. Jerusalem is a field of weeds. Our holy and beautiful temple, which our ancestors filled with your praises, was burned down by fire. All our lovely parks and gardens in ruins. In the face of this, are you going to sit there unmoved, God? Aren't you going to say something? Haven't you made us miserable long enough?" Isaiah may be a nuisance, but he does give us permission to address God directly, to talk to our Creator, saying, "Where are you anyway? And what are your plans to make things right around here?" The Gospel of Mark professes that the master of the house has gone away. He will return, but nobody knows when. The followers of Jesus in the first century AD had a problem because they were expecting Jesus to return literally any minute. This gospel, Mark's gospel, is the earliest gospel account to be written down, and it has this sort of breathless prose that gives one the sense that the author wasn't even expecting the ink to dry on the page before Jesus came back. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. The illustration gives four possible times when Jesus could return: at evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn. Let's imagine for a minute. If the master of the house came in the evening, perhaps there might be some leftovers on the stove, and a couple of lights would still be on. If the master of the house returned at dawn, maybe coffee would already be brewing. But what about at midnight? What about at cockcrow, which would be around 4:30 a.m. during that blue hour? The paradox of Advent is that it's a season during which we acknowledge the apparent absence of God, even in church. God's apparent unavailability manifests right there in the scriptures and right in front of us in our world too, 2,000 years after Mark's gospel was written down. Any religion that talks about God always being visible, near, and available just is not biblical. Isaiah acknowledges the absence of God, and he says it straight to God's face. Isaiah begs God to deliver his people from sin and to restore the temple, and most of all, to make himself known. The psalmist's refrain, which we all just read together, is, "Restore us, O Lord, God of hosts. Show us the light of your countenance, and we shall be saved." When the news gives us images of war and destruction and of a ceasefire broken, it can feel like there are no words left to be said, and it can be tempting to give up hope, to turn away, and just to default to red and green. But Isaiah gives us that template for talking about it to God, saying, "In the face of this, are you going to sit there unmoved, God? Aren't you going to say something? Haven't you made us miserable long enough?" In the chapters immediately following today's reading, Isaiah joyfully anticipates God's inbreaking into the lives of the Israelites and into our lives too. He tells them to festively prepare for a new Jerusalem. He talks about a holy land where there's enough for everyone to eat, where babies grow up into healthy adults who live to see their grandchildren. And most critically, he imagines a people where each and every one of us knows the joy of living close to God. This blue of Advent, it asks us to take an honest inventory of the problems in our world that are unsolvable without God, and to joyfully await for his coming to us. "Therefore, keep awake," Jesus says to the crowds, "for you do not know when the master of the house will come." In the very next chapter in Mark's gospel, Jesus asks his disciples to do just one thing: to sit and wait up for him while he prays in Gethsemane. And Jesus returns to his friends three separate times, and each time he finds them sleeping. Could you not keep awake 1 hour? "Keep awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial," Jesus says to them. There's a quietness to the blue. Maybe there's a sense of unease. There are shadows. And there is the truth that we do have a strained relationship with our Creator. But in those earliest hours of the morning, in those quietest hours, there is a deep hope and a deep joy and an assurance that the light will come soon.